Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSB Magazine. You're listening to a new The Changemaking Podcast with Chloe Mestoghi. Each episode will introduce an area of technology that needs work and highlight the changemakers working on it. Join Chloe and guests as they tap into their passion about equity and rights for all. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
And welcome to the Changemaking Podcast on ITSB Magazine. And with me today, I have Scott Shackelford. Scott, say hello.
Hello, and thanks so much for having me.
And likewise, I'm glad to have you on here. So you recently gave a talk with Chris Hart on the case for a National Cybersecurity Safety Board. And I'm very excited to have you here. And for those that don't know who Scott is, he is Associate Professor, Chair, and Cybersecurity Risk Management Program Executive Director at Ostrom Workshop at Indiana University. And he's doing so much work, and it's been in the news too for since last week, I would say, right?
Yeah, no, luckily some of these ideas are actually gaining traction, including, like you said at the outset, this National Cyber Safety Board concept. So that's been great.
Wonderful. So let's just dive into it. So the first question I have for you is, what is the current layout of cyber attacks today versus those in the past?
You know, I wish I could give you a nice, you know, fully built out, robust answer to that. But as you and I'm sure the listeners are aware, you know, we don't have a really nice 30,000 foot level for the types of cyber attacks happening, you know, around the country, to say nothing of around the world, and how that's changing. And that's, you know, partly a result, frankly, of until pretty recently, a lot of organizations not having to report incidents. That's starting to change. We have, you know, 50 different versions of these data breach notification laws across the states. The Biden administration is putting some new requirements on incident response. And of course, it's being talked about in Congress. More progress has been made in the EU. So without that kind of robust incident reporting, we're kind of left to rely on what we do know about, which is snippets, and is, you know, oftentimes, frankly, just coming from vendors. What we know from that context is that it looks like, you know, overall cyber attacks, ransomware attacks in particular, are only increasing year on year. We saw a big uptake during the pandemic, of course, unfortunately, in ransomware attacks across a variety of different targets, industries, and sectors, including healthcare, which is, of course, incredibly concerning right now. We just had an attack on Eskenazi Health here in Indianapolis just last week. So, you know, overall trend lines, we are, it's not all doom and gloom. You know, we are doing better across some contexts, like, you know, viruses, worms, that kind of thing. Anti-malware has definitely helped with that. But, you know, overall losses to phishing, kind of the new frontier of these zero click attacks, where you don't even have to, you know, click on a link to have your smartphone or your computer infected. And of course, the ongoing ransomware epidemic is certainly concerning.
Definitely sounds like a scary world right now. But as you said, it is, things are starting to come together, which is a good thing, especially since there were so many breaches during this pandemic right now. And unfortunately, a lot of them happen to be our healthcare in many ways. So I have another question for you, which is, what is the current role of the National Transportation Safety Board when it comes to looking into cyber attacks?
Yeah, you know, the NTSB as a model, we find, you know, to be pretty interesting, because for, you know, decades at this point, since it was fully rolled out as an independent agency in the 60s, and one of only two independent agencies, I might add, across the entirety of the federal government, it's had a really broad mandate to investigate a variety of transportation accidents, and in some cases, even disasters, and really get to the bottom of what happened, not only technical failures, failings, but even organizational failings, like we saw in the aftermath of the Challenger and Columbia space shuttle accidents. So I think there's a lot there that we can talk about that's interesting. When you look at cybersecurity in particular, it's important to note that the NTSB isn't empowered to investigate incidents that are purposeful, right? That are actually caused by, you know, criminals or even foreign nation states. So that's when things get turned over to other aspects of the government. That's obviously, unfortunately, all too common when it comes to cyber attacks and cybersecurity. But the NTSB has been involved in various investigations that do include a cyber component, even, I might add, the Colonial pipeline incidents, right? Because that, believe it or not, gas pipelines fall under the NTSB's mandate there. So even there is an existing role for the NTSB to play, but it's certainly not one focused on cybersecurity. So that's why we're interested in exploring that model and exploring that analogy. And that's why we're excited about the Biden administration's proposal here to actually stand up a cyber safety review board, which is certainly a step in the direction of the true National Cybersecurity Safety Board modeled after the NTSB.
I would have to admit it's a long time coming. It's so needed, especially with everything that's going on and the SolarWinds attack from last year, which leads me to wanting to know is how did the SolarWinds attack showed us that we need more preventive than reactive mechanisms in place? And the reason I ask this is because I always find that security, our industry, and then outside of our industry, it's always seen that we're more reactive than preventative. And I feel like the SolarWinds kind of showcase us like why preventative, we need to invest in it more. But I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
SolarWinds was a wake-up call, you know, across a number of different fronts. Like the concerns over supply chain attacks, I mean, those have been percolating in cybersecurity communities for many years at this point. But they, you know, were more or less confined to those communities. With SolarWinds and frankly, some of the attacks that have happened since, including Exchange to a degree, you know, we've seen this really come to the fore in a way that really wasn't the case beforehand. So it's not only the case now that we have, you know, CISOs and chief privacy officers and CEOs talking about this. We have really all facets of organizations from the board of directors on down, and we see this percolating across policy circles as well. So, you know, this was a great proof of concept, right? And it was, you know, it's clear why foreign adversaries, in this case, like Russia, prefer these types of attacks, since instead of just targeting a single organization and trying to find vulnerabilities to exploit, you can go after a vendor that serves, like in the case of SolarWinds, 18,000 plus, and potentially get backdoors into numerous, you know, high profile systems. And who knows, you know, what kinds of intelligence and trade secrets you'll be able to garner as a result of that. So you get a lot more bang for your buck. As a result, this type of attack is not going away. And the problem is, you know, a lot of our efforts recently, including in the defense space, to establish supply chain security frameworks like the CMMC, you know, really didn't do very much and couldn't do very much to protect against the type of attack we saw in SolarWinds. So not only it's a wake-up call as to the severity of this issue, but also that we need to update our existing frameworks to better account, you know, for these types of exploits.
Would you say that security apathy has remained still consistent post-SolarWinds, or do you think it has reduced?
You know, again, a lot of my evidence to support what I'm about to say is pretty anecdotal. But I will say that we do have some data now, especially over the last year, that even you know, early 2020, for example, concern levels were high, but they do only seem to be increasing with regards to various kinds of cyber attacks, including, frankly, supply chain attacks, and even related concerns like misinformation. To give you one example of that, we did a report here in Indiana for our executive council on cybersecurity that we did in partnership with different aspects of our state government. The report's called State of Hoosier Cybersecurity 2020. It's freely available online. And it's the first kind of state level snapshot we have. We asked a lot of questions around cyber hygiene and best practices, cyber risk insurance, a lot of those kind of related areas. And, you know, to answer that question, 95% of our respondents to this survey were either somewhat or very concerned about cyber attacks. And that was, you know, relatively early in 2020 when the bulk of those data, those responses were collected. So, I mean, already this was at a pretty high level. Now, there was a lot of confusion still about what do we do about that. But I think the message is getting out that this is clearly an area of concern.
So you did mention a little bit earlier about the supply chain. And I was curious, is what has been the approach to the supply chain in cybersecurity right now with everything that has basically has happened over the past year, especially during this pandemic? And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on that, as well as the, how is this go it alone security approach starting to fail?
Right. You know, this was a big topic, even at Black Hat, right, around whose responsibility is supply chain security. And, you know, one of the easy takeaways, and it's easy to kind of scoff at it, is, well, you know, it's everybody's responsibility. But then, of course, if it's everybody's responsibility, is it anybody's responsibility at the end of the day? Clearly, you know, we got to have engaged leadership from the top down. Including the board of directors, you know, having dedicated committees looking at various types of risks, cyber risk in particular, but also leadership from the C-suite to really consider different aspects of supply chain security, even as part of mergers and acquisition deals, right? You know, what not only what assets are you gaining as a result of a new venture, you know, but what risks, right? What vendors, what business partners are the potential entity that you're acquiring, you know, using in turn? These networks are vast. It still is not well understood, and it's tough to quantify sometimes what those risks can be. And we've seen the results, right? Whether it was several years ago at this point with, you know, Verizon, you know, for example, acquisition of Yahoo and what we learned about the aftermath of that. Even to what we saw in the UK with TalkTalk, and they had an acquisition where they basically were breached as a result of their recently acquired company's website having vulnerabilities. So this whole issue of supply chain security, I think, you know, again, we're talking about it more, which is great, but I'm still concerned that the tools that we have to really manage this and for those at the top to really understand all the nuance here are not nearly as mature as they need to be.
I have a giant smile on my face for everything that you just shared. So the thing is that the critical infrastructure seems so vulnerable. And I wanted to hear, what are some ways that you think can it be improved on?
I think there's a lot of room for improvement here, clearly. And the good news is, you know, there is actual progress that is being made. Now, clearly, it's also a game of, you know, constantly playing catch up here. But, you know, the fact that there is some catching up happening is also encouraging. And we see that coming from a few different organizations at the federal level, like NIST, of course, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. They've taken, you know, really a leading role in developing cybersecurity frameworks, you know, since 2014, privacy frameworks, Internet of Things frameworks more recently, and now supply chain frameworks. So that's a step in the right direction. The Biden administration's executive orders around software supply chain security are also promising. Again, very early days for how that's going to play out. And CISA, which is our cybersecurity critical infrastructure agency at the Department of Homeland Security, at DHS, they're really taking the lead on building out what that's going to look like. But frankly, they need a lot of help. They're trying to aggressively hire, but I just encourage folks who are listening, who might be interested to check it out, right? Check out CISA because, you know, we need good people interested in this stuff and willing to give back. Cybersecurity is one of those invaluable helping professions, and the federal government can't do it alone. This is a classic example of public-private partnerships, which a lot of us continue to scoff at because oftentimes we're really good at, you know, sharing information between companies and the government, not so good at the reverse. But, you know, we're never going to get a handle on this problem if we can't, you know, come together. And I'm encouraged, you know, by some of those green shoots that I see, you know, happening. And just frankly, the that high degree of concern clearly that the Biden administration has shown about this issue and the extent to which they're willing to elevate it, frankly, to the highest levels, as we saw with, you know, President Biden's recent summit with President Putin and with the G7 and our NATO allies. So I think it's getting the attention it deserves, but we still need to do a better job of linking together everything we have to offer in the private sector and across academia and civil society. Again, easier said than done, for sure. But we have a tremendous amount of resources that are at our beck and call. It's just a matter of organizing and coordinating those efforts.
The next question I have, then, it has something to do with what you've mentioned, which is like, this is a time for us to come together. We have to come together at this point from everything that we have seen in the past year or so of not basically being behind the times when attacks occur. Having a National Cybersecurity Safety Board is a must at this time. And I wanted for you in this opportunity to share why it's needed and how would it work?
Yeah, I mean, first off, to be clear, this is not just, you know, Chris and I's idea here. Like the idea of establishing a National Cybersecurity Safety Board modeled after the NTSB, it's been around, frankly, since the early days of what we call, you know, loosely cyber attacks. A couple of years after the Morris Worm, in fact, in 1991, there was the first government report calling for something like an NTSB for cybersecurity. And we've seen the idea kind of pop up here and there in the decades since, but I really think we are at a boiling point now because in part of what's been happening, and we've already referenced some of those events even over this last year, but also frankly, because there's been a logjam of different ideas for a while now in Congress. And I think there's been just some concern that of just kind of throwing up hands, of just not knowing, frankly, what to do. This is one of those low-hanging fruit options that I think has a lot of bipartisan buy-in. There's clearly going to be resistance for sure in some aspects of industry that, you know, the tech sector has long been anathema to this kind of these kind of investigatory teams taking a look, right, at what they've been up to. Who wouldn't be? I get it. But there's also different aspects of industry, including insurance, that would have, you know, a tremendous amount to gain. So, you know, just in brief, I see several really useful, you know, goals that are that a National Cyber Safety Board could help further. Among those are the fact that in the aftermath of attacks like SolarWinds, you know, we don't have an authoritative, comprehensive report come out that you can thud on a desk or that can hit a laptop screen, and you can get a view, an interdisciplinary, comprehensive as possible view on what went wrong, when, why, and what do we do about it, right? That's what happens in the aftermath of, for example, an airplane disaster. We don't have anything like that for cybersecurity. We have some immediate reactions. There's some patches. There's some press releases that go out, but we don't have that report. And as a result, you know, we keep running into the same issues time and again. We keep having to, you know, get the word out. Now, not all of these, you know, types of attacks, and Chris Hart, I think, has said this, and I think would agree, would need to be investigated. Now, there's tens, there's hundreds of thousands, however you want to, you know, draw the boundaries of cyber attacks happening across most organizations all the time, right? Clearly, something like an NTSB couldn't investigate all of those. And we've been involved in various discussions, including a forthcoming report from the Harvard Belfer Center on how to draw those lines. And you can do it in various ways. For example, novel attacks, so those using zero-day exploits, only investigating attacks on critical infrastructure, or maybe just specific aspects of critical infrastructure to begin with to kind of prove the concept there, or those involving X number of people. Some, you know, thresholds that have been thrown out are 10 million people or $40 million. Again, reasonable people can disagree on what those thresholds should be. But clearly, they need to be drawn in a purposeful way that involves multiple stakeholders. And from there, you know, having these interdisciplinary teams take a hard look at what happened and have those teams empowered with, for example, subpoena powers to actually be able to go out to gather the data that's needed, of course, to maintain it in a confidential way, to pull from various experts with different backgrounds, from organizational governance to computer forensics, whatever it might be, to get make a solid sense for what failings happen than to put out these reports. Now, to be clear, the NTSB, for example, doesn't have the power to put out these reports and then automatically their suggestions and findings, you know, become law. But oftentimes the recommendations either do become established industry best practices quite quickly, and still frequently Congress acts and decides to codify those. And we hope for something similar here in this context, where those recommendations, those findings, even if it's recommendations that many of us in the security community have been discussing for years, decades at this point, those start to become more well-established. And this national, indeed global conversation we're having right now about what the heck is reasonable cybersecurity, well, these kind of reports could really inform that discussion. So that's why I'm excited about this possibility.
It definitely is something that's been needed. And I know that the security community has been really wanting something like this for some time, because it's been a lot of us being vocal. Hey, we got these issues we need to look into, and then just not being heard, or no actions are taken, or we'll see things written on paper or things that are shared in statements, but we haven't really seen too much actions. And I think we're at that point where we have an administration that's willing to take actions. Is there any other countries that have some sort of similar board?
You know, we did look around when we were working on this presentation for Black Hat, and I did a separate symposium article a couple years ago. And we couldn't identify any country with an established, you know, national cybersecurity safety board of the kind that we're describing here. The closest that we could find were, you know, versions of what we have in the U.S., these information sharing and analysis centers, these ISACs. And in the EU, for example, they have international cooperation groups where they have representatives from all the EU member states coming together and talking about, you know, cyber threats that they commonly face and investigating, you know, recent incidents. GDPR helps with that because of the European Commission is empowered to enforce the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU. And they've been doing that to the tune of, you know, hundreds of organizations since that came to being more than 3 years ago now. So, you know, there are some institutions out there, along with, of course, cyber emergency response teams or certs around the world, that could help and could become partners in this effort. But that would clearly need to be, you know, another important piece of this puzzle if we're going to really see and realize all the benefits of an NTSB model. The NTSB is effective, but it's only effective because, frankly, it has a global network of other NTSB-like organizations, along with, frankly, an international organization to help coordinate them and coordinate their efforts. We're a heck of a long way from anything like that when it comes to cybersecurity, but having that type of international information sharing around cyber threats, those types of comprehensive reports, just imagine what that could do, for example, for like a global ransomware epidemic like we saw with WannaCry or NotPetya. Right now, we lean on, frankly, the good offices of security researchers, of different vendors and different government agencies to do what they can, right, and get the word out as they're able. But if we actually had a framework like that set up, just like we see after a jet airline disaster, you know, it's a very well orchestrated, you know, framework of different organizations coming together, doing the investigation, sharing information, and getting the word out. I think that last point about getting the word out is an interesting one to consider here too. Just in terms of, you know, sometimes these NTSB-like or reports can take more than a year to put together. Now, in cybersecurity, obviously, we oftentimes don't have that long to wait, right? There could be potentially numerous victims that unfortunately could be attacked in the meantime. So there has to be a balancing act here. And the Biden administration, you know, for example, called for 3 months or so to put out these reports. I think it's just going to have to depend. And there could be a bit of a triage that happens where maybe some of the you know, findings that are core that relate to ongoing vulnerabilities get out there quickly, you know, within that 3 month window. But then we still can have the benefits of this comprehensive report coming out, you know, 6 months, a year later. So difficult balancing act to be sure, but that's another one we're going to have to strike.
And It would be wonderful if this does happen, because I always think of when it comes to legislation, whenever the US comes with a new legislation, other countries start looking into that, possibly creating bills themselves or creating boards themselves on that. And I'm hoping that this becomes kind of like a ripple effect, that we create something like this and then other countries follow. And then hopefully one day we'll have something more on a global scale. We would have an overseeing in a sense of helping all throughout different governments become more cybersecurity savvy all around the world. That would be a wonderful thing.
I couldn't agree more, you know, and for a while there, the U.S. was really a pioneer on cyber policy. I mean, we were home to the first ever cyber emergency response team that was stood up way back in the late 80s in response to the Morris Worm that we mentioned earlier. Right. Yeah. But frankly, we've really ceded a lot of that in large part to the EU, which has become kind of a global epicenter for data governance. And I'd love to see us, frankly, take a more coordinated approach here and not necessarily, you know, take the mantle back, but be able to put out some models, some innovations like this National Cyber Safety Board that would really, again, resonate and would help us, you know, make it a little bit easier to work with our friends and allies around the world, and even, frankly, antagonists, since we're all in the same boat here. No nation is an island in cyberspace, no matter how much some wish they were, frankly.
I completely agree on that whole, none of us are on an island. We have to actually kind of work together because, you know, attackers are everywhere. Literally, attackers are everywhere, and it's up to us to work across to, you know, protect one another. I know that when it comes to talking about cybersecurity or security in general with our elective officials, sometimes it can be challenging because they don't have a background in it. So I was wondering if you have any advice or any way that we, the listeners, can take action in a way to try to get Congress to create this Cybersecurity Safety Board. And so then we can start investigating breaches better, more effectively and faster by having something in place that does that review.
Certainly. Well, there's always the classic strategy of reaching out to your representatives. And, you know, for example, Senator Mark Warner has been a very vocal proponent of this concept, especially over the last 6 months or so. So, you know, giving him support, getting your local officials, your representatives involved, even your senators, as they consider different cyber reform legislation, that always resonates. There's also the opportunity, frankly, to help by either volunteering unofficially or even, you know, trying to formalize it. And what I mean by that is there's going to be a real need on these interdisciplinary investigatory teams to engage, you know, with the private sector. That's where a lot of the resources, that's where a lot of the know-how is. And if companies that are, and representatives that might be listening now, you know, could start thinking about, well, you know, if we wanted to set up a program, almost a service model where we'd be willing to let, you know, some of our employees volunteer to work on these teams to investigate the aftermath of breaches for a certain, you know, a certain percentage of their overall time. That would not only, of course, benefit all of us in terms of our shared responsibility for cybersecurity, but potentially, you know, these employees as well, because they're going to bring back a lot of insights and know-how to their own organizations. And that's one reason I've also been advocating for a while now. And I was happy to see or hear Jen Easterly at Black Hat to get on board with this idea of a cyber corps. I called it a cyber peace corps in a piece I did for Slate a few years ago, which is, you know, a building off of AmeriCorps and the Peace Corps concept to basically create a service opportunity, right? A service program for students. You know, they can get their degrees paid for in return for some amount, some duration of service, either here locally in the U.S. or for, you know, a different organization, because there's there's a lot of capacity building that needs to happen around the world in this space. So, you know, organizations don't have to wait for the Congress to mm-hmm. act or the government to do that kind of thing. We saw some of that volunteering happening during the last election cycle. And there's no reason that, you know, for example, even one particular state or a region of the country couldn't set up a board like this, just targeted at one sector that might be particularly in the crosshairs, like healthcare right now. So I think there's a lot of experimentation that should be done. Again, these are early days, and I want to be clear that this is no panacea. Nothing is, right? But I really do think it could help. And frankly, like I'm reminded of that famous FDR quote about just try, you know, even if you fall flat, just try something. And that's where I think we are in cyber policy now, is like, you know, clearly all of these ideas have drawbacks, but I think we just need to try more of them to get a better sense for what those drawbacks are. And we can learn from them and take it from there.
I completely agree on the stalling thing. I think we're always so worried that if we don't take an action that's going to provide the perfection in society, then we're hesitant to take that step forward. But the reality is nothing is going to be perfect. However, we have to take that first step to learn how to even do better and to just keep on improving and keep working through it. Thank you, Scott, so much for sharing this information with everyone. If anyone wants to get a hold of Scott, his details will be below on LinkedIn and on Twitter, as well as the links on cyberrisk.iu.edu and the Ostrom workshop at Indiana University. Thank you, Scott, once again. I really appreciate it. And I hope everyone's staying safe and well.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Changemaking Podcast with Chloe Mestaghi. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.